Welcome to the HIV Australia podcast, a discussion about the community-led response to HIV. In this episode, Professor Kane Race speaks to Dr. J.R. Latham, who talks about the needs of trans and gender-diverse people in Australia on access to healthcare.
My name is Kane Race. I'm a professor of gender and cultural studies at the University of Sydney, and it's my very great pleasure to introduce Dr. J.R. Latham, who we'll be having a discussion with today. Dr. Latham is the Alfred Deakin Postdoctoral Research Fellow at Deakin University and an Honorary Fellow in Cultural Studies at the University of Melbourne in Australia. He's a social scientist and feminist theorist with expertise in health and medicine, transgender and sexuality studies. And he's received a number of awards from scholarly journals for his research and writing. Last year, in 2021, Joe wrote a paper for HIV Australia on the HIV prevention needs of trans and gender diverse people in Australia. The paper can be found on the AFAO website under HIV Australia. And we're here today to chat about some of the issues raised in the paper. So let's get started. Hi, Joe. Great to be talking to you. Before we chat about the paper that you wrote for HIV Australia, could you give us a little bit of background about yourself and some of the research that you've done with trans and gender diverse people?
Yeah, sure. Thanks so much, Kane. Thanks for having me. Thanks to HIV Australia. It's really great to have the opportunity to talk about my work in this different forum and hopefully reach some more people. Yeah, so I've been doing research on trans people's experience of medicine for about 10 years now. As a trans person myself, it's something that I've been very passionate about. I've done different kinds of research with different kinds of people, qualitative research, which is interviewing people about their experiences, queer and trans people, various ages and different experiences in Australia. I've also done interviews with older people, and I've also done a host of research on different kinds of texts, media texts, and clinical literature about transgender medicine. So I think of my broad sort of research interests as being based around how trans people, trans men especially, experience the processes of different kind of medical practices and healthcare, and as well as how clinicians experiences those processes as well, and how they sort of think about them in different ways, some ways that go together and some ways that clash.
Mm. Great. Having read the paper, I mean, it's a really thorough overview that clearly draws on that body of research and unpacks the kinds of issues that general practitioners and other clinicians and health workers might need to consider when they have trans and gender diverse patients. One of the things you talk about in the paper is how many trans and gender diverse people experience an adversarial relation to medical care. Could you talk a little bit about that and flesh it out a bit for us and how it can impact the provision of care, including in relation to HIV?
I think this is quite a foundational issue to how both trans people and clinicians understand their experiences of encountering each other in medical processes, though it's not necessarily something that people are particularly aware of. And it has a lot to do with the way medicine for trans people has been developed historically. So historically, trans people needed to go through a fairly rigorous psychiatric assessment process in order to be approved for any kind of therapeutic intervention. And that process still continues today. It's been changed a lot in the decades since it started, but the foundational situation of trans people needing to prove themselves in order to gain access to particular medical therapy has put people in a position of a sort of doubting professional, where clinicians are put in this position of sort of needing to be suspicious of trans people. Their job is to, in that situation, is to decide, is this someone I can approve for surgeries and hormones or not. And in the power relation of that relationship, it makes it very difficult for trans people to be able to assert what it is that they want, because what it is that they want is framed within a selection criteria of a psychiatric assessment. So what that means is people going through that process of transitioning medically need to be able to describe their experience in ways that clinicians can match up to the selection criteria of that diagnosis. And trans people know that, and they've known that for decades. And what that means is that trans people read that selection criteria and they find ways to think about themselves in ways that fit those selection criteria so they can be approved for surgery. And having that kind of relation with someone that is supposed to be a healthcare professional, I think has really profound impacts into those ongoing relationships throughout people's lives of needing healthcare, right, which all people do.
That's really interesting. And, you know, it sounds to me a lot like healthcare providers would be put in a, just on the basis of that history, in a sort of a gatekeeping role, and that trans and gender diverse patients must almost feel like they're auditioning to get access to the medical services that they want, and that can limit the kinds of information that they feel like it's okay to share. Is that an okay take on the sort of things that you're saying there?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Kane. Thanks. I think it is. I think that is precisely, you know, sort of if you're, you know, you want to sort of be able to be as descriptive as possible with particular healthcare issues that you need, right? This is like a foundational principle of medicine, is that you should be able to be honest and to be able to articulate and describe what your experience is in order to be able to get the best healthcare that you can. And I think one of the ongoing effects of that psychiatric process is trans people feel stifled in that experience. And they, and I, you know, I know this from having done this research, that it's extremely common for trans people to go on to have, you know, anxiety, to have fear, to have reluctance at accessing any kind of healthcare because of going through this experience of gatekeeping, of needing to prove yourself, and of, I guess, like, of having to partake in a particular kind of dishonesty that potentially, like, isn't something that trans people really want to be doing at all, but feel as though, you know, they need to fit into these particular descriptive diagnostic categories in order to access healthcare.
Mm. Yeah, it's really an important point, I think. You highlight in the paper the sexual health needs of trans and gender diverse people. What are some of the assumptions about trans and gender diverse people and their lives that can affect sexual health care in particular?
Yeah, again, it's important to understand the sort of history of how transgender medicine has operated, because it was based on an assumption that trans people didn't have a sexuality really at all. It's a bit more complicated than that. There was sort of, you know, trans people sort of understood categorically to be the hypersexualized or completely lacking in sexuality. And in order to access hormones or surgeries, you needed to fit into that latter category. So there was an understanding that trans people were so filled with self-loathing and hatred of their own bodies that they just wouldn't be able to interact sexually with other people, that those things would just naturally make sense in that kind of medical logic, that, like, well, if you hate yourself, you're not going to be having sex with other people. And that then led to this host of inaccuracies about how trans people are understood in medicine, and also just a huge lack of clinical research and therefore data to be able to know what it is that are actually the best courses of action for trans people in their sexual health needs, and in particular kinds of, you know, HIV prevention and STI prevention. That assuming that trans people don't have sex, first of all, is like, well, you know, that's a terrible place to start with if you're talking about sexual health with people. There are also huge assumptions about the kinds of sex that trans people will have, That tends to be very kind of heterosexually based on non-trans people, like that trans people just sort of imitate heterosexual people and have sex like that. Again, like, I don't know, you know, being a queer person, you know, all of this sort of like straight people ways of thinking about sex are baffling to me. But I think like the idea that trans people will avoid sexual relationships is very, very common. It's very common, like contemporarily, this is still very common. And I think that that shuts down sort of from the start all kinds of information and questions and rapport that the clinicians could be having with their patients if they were open to the idea that trans people, like all other people, can have all kinds of sex that comes along with all kinds of risks. And I think, yeah, relatedly, that the one of the ways that affects people's access to sexual health care is, again, with this sort of caution about talking about it with their doctors. And yeah, I guess a fear of having, of coming into contact with those assumptions and then having to either sort of educate people about how that's not the case, or be greeted with, you know, hostility at having like come out about those sorts of things. Yeah, these are real sort of barriers to having caring relationships between a doctor and patient, which is obviously what is needed in order to be able to give people the best kind of sexual health care they can as individuals, which is the only way to create a kind of public health situation or environment where HIV can be, HIV transmission can be eliminated, right?
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that it's hard enough to talk about your sex life for anybody, actually, in the context of a clinical encounter. But when there's been this history where, you know, the diagnostic procedures, some of them stipulate sort of a hatred of genitals as you know, a characteristic of trans people until they get particular, you know, transitioning or gender affirming surgeries. So I can imagine that even any sort of discussion of genital pleasure and particularly sort of non-gender appropriate genital pleasure would be shut down by that, those expectations and histories, and or potentially shut down. I mean, what can healthcare providers do about that? Do you think?
Yeah, well, a lot. And I think you're exactly right. Like, I think we do find ourselves at a point, a real sort of like, I don't know, tipping point, obviously it's been overused, but like at this sort of clash point of having lived with the consequences of this kind of really outdated sort of like archaic gender stereotype way of understanding trans people through that medical diagnosis, at the same time as having this huge sort of like social movement for trans and gender diverse and non-binary, especially people, making a huge amount of sort of like social movement in saying like, hey, we're all kinds of different people. And I think like, you know, that this is a really exciting time for medicine to like, you know, really kind of pick it up and like, and get on board with how the world has changed, you know, particularly in the past like 10 years, but in terms of the research I've done, it goes back to what, about 70 years ago. So, and I think like, it's actually like really quite straightforward. I think like there's so many ways that, you know, everything about gender and sexuality is understood to be so sort of like complicated and like scary, especially in this sort of like Western white people context from where medicine comes from, that it sort of has these ideas that what clinicians can actually do to like improve relationships with trans people, which is just to like just make them possible. I think like so much of what happens in the relationships between clinicians and patients, and like, again, I guess so much of what I've been talking about in terms of like patients, trans people having these sort of fears and having this sort of like caution and hesitancy around disclosing things to practitioners, I think that clinicians have not similar, but inverted, I guess, sort of fears about offending trans people. I mean, I know that that is the case, and that presents a different kind of barrier there's been sort of quite a lot of, I guess, ways of trying to sort of deal with this problem have tended to sort of skew towards sort of like educational training and, you know, teaching people, you know, the right sort of words to use. And I think those are really important things, like information to be out there. But in terms of what, you know, clinicians need to actually be doing in their interpersonal relationships with patients, with trans people, is like, is just being open to the fact that they may be assuming all kinds of things that are wrong about the person they're dealing with. Fundamentally, they might assume that they're not trans. Like, that's, you know, often a giant assumption that people who can appear to not be trans encounter, which is being somewhere where someone just makes the assumption that they're not trans, and then it's sort of up to the trans person to have to sort of unpack, like, oh, where do I think this assumption is coming from? Is it a friendly assumption that I can push back against? Is it one that I'll be greeted with hostility? And yeah, I guess the thing that I've been thinking about more recently, especially since doing this work with HIV Australia, is really thinking about what kind of a care approach in a general sense is really what's needed. I think people sort of talk about, you know, like inclusive care. I think like that's kind of become a bit of a buzzword, which I don't really like, because it's just sort of like inclusive to who? I think like if you've done any kind of work in like, you know, like disability studies or like people with disability, like as I have, it's just like you can't include everyone. That's just a reality of people's needs, that people's needs are different. So you need to be specific about, well, who, like, what does inclusive care mean? Like, who are you actually including? So I think that's sort of meaningless. But, you know, what we really need is just a kind of like informed openness to people's differences, which I feel like is quite a simple thing to be asking, but also one which I know that, you know, from like the history of these, the assumptions that are made about people's sexual practices based on their identities, that medicine's had a real difficulty doing.
Really interesting. Now, you talk in the paper about hesitancy in healthcare, and I'm taking hesitancy to just mean avoiding doctors. Is that correct?
I think, you know, I guess hesitancy in sort of like, often it can be people delaying seeking services. So sort of like being like, oh, I feel sick, but I really don't want to go to the doctor, so I won't. And then also like being in an actual sort of encounter of health services and then being reluctant or hesitant or unknowing about whether sort of disclosing their transness or whatever their history is, as to how safe and effective that is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's certainly, I mean, I guess the way that trans people can experience sort of hostility or discrimination in sort of healthcare services can be quite sort of subtle. I mean, it doesn't seem subtle to us, but I can see how it seems subtle to other people and sort of insidious. Like, one of the most sort of common ones, which I think is really obvious, is sort of using the wrong pronouns for people, which is not subtle, but it's sort of a, again, I think like a lot of the work of sort of dealing with this problem of like, oh, okay, there's this problem of like trans people can't get healthcare, or there's this problem of like doctors don't know how to treat trans people. And so much of that problem is constituted in a way where like trans people are responsible for it. And I guess like, yeah, I just like to open it up a little bit and say maybe there are these ways where clinicians could sort of act in different ways that would really shut down a lot of those fears on both sides. That's what I would hope for.
In the paper, one of the things you talk about is the accessibility and availability of healthcare, including through both mainstream services and also specialist services. Can you talk to us a little about this?
Yeah, I think, I guess because I really believe passionately in universal healthcare, like that is that, you know, trans people should be able to access any and all health services that we need. So I really think that it is urgent and necessary for all kinds of health services to think about how they're doing this, think about how they're capable of treating trans people with the kinds of, you know, like personal respect and dignity. They're also like buzzwords. So it's like as though we're these sort of like special people that need to be treated specially, but like respect and dignity is like what everyone expects when they go to get healthcare or should do, are entitled to, should have access to. So I think that it's really necessary for all services to be capable of doing what trans people need in order to be treated as patients. And I think there can be a kind of diffusion of responsibility around that with the kind of advent of specialist services that are specifically for trans people. So I think that it's a really good thing there are those specialist services. I think they're definitely absolutely needed, and they're needed because in large part trans people simply can't get mainstream services. They can't use them because of a whole host of issues stemming from just that kind of discrimination of what it's like to be a trans person. So I think it's really important to have those services, but I think they need to be a sort of stopgap. They need to be something that is sort of, okay, this is like a temporary thing where we're trying to understand how we can do the best job of treating these people. We clearly have shown that we've not been doing a good job of treating, and then I would like to see them dissipated. I would like to see a world where trans people are treated like all other people.
Absolutely. I mean, when you think about sort of the distribution of these services as well, I mean, you know, gender clinics, for example, are located in particular places. Not everybody might be able to access those places on a, you know, immediate day-to-day level for their sexual health or general care needs. As you were talking, I was struck by how, you know, if we're thinking at the level of family doctors, or just doctors in, you know, general practitioners, that becoming sort of more aware of these issues, you know, is really important for trans and gender diverse people, but also is probably really important more generally. If I, for example, present as a man and I go to my general practitioner and we start to have a conversation about my sexual practices, it's really important for that practitioner not to assume that because of how I present, I'm going to, you know, engage in a particular set of stereotype practices. It may be that I, you know, have sex with different kinds of partners or use different, have sex in different ways than how my presentation might appear to that practitioner. So there's something, you know, interesting about that, I think, that, you know, general practitioners in mainstream services, I reckon, would do well to sort of think about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I'm also cognizant that they do get quite poor sexual health training, as far as I can understand. So there is sort of a broader issue here of sort of medical doctors and sexuality, you know, being a sort of taboo subject, gender being a taboo subject, trans people having sex being just sort of like ultra like scary in that sense of being such an unknown. But I think, yeah, I mean, the example that you give is really helpful because I think it is really like, I find myself having quite a simple request, which is just like, just stop assuming and just ask respectful questions. And questions which aren't, you know, like based in your sort of morbid curiosity, but in the actual clinical needs you can assess that this person might have. And I see, you know, I've seen people in my own sort of like anecdotal life experience of having healthcare Like, you know, I've seen them do it. I've seen it like tick over in their mind. You know, when, yeah, like, you know, I've sort of had to do something where people have, you know, thought that I'm not a trans man, and you know, I've told them that I am, and you know, I can just see them sort of say like, oh, okay, so that means like this thing and this thing and this thing, and therefore I'll ask this question. And it's really quite straightforward, you know. But I think there's been, you know, in this sort of like mystification and scariness of trans people, which has obviously been very much poured fuel in the flames of in this country and many others, that trans people are this sort of like scary, like predatory force. And like, you know, I think firstly that's, you know, wildly like untrue and not very likely. I'd like to see a quant study on trans people versus non-trans people and our violence towards others. But I also, you know, unfortunately am aware of the fact that trans people do have a heightened vulnerability to exploitation in relationships, for example, having less, and again, this is like having less access to not just healthcare, but a social world puts people in a higher risk for all kinds of things that are difficult. Social experiences and also healthcare needs, you know, to get back to sort of what I was saying before about like hesitancy and reluctance, and especially coming out of all the lockdowns we've been through where people's preventative healthcare has been completely like thrown out the window, is that like, you know, we know in medicine that the earlier you get treatment for something, the better that it is. And putting people into a category that makes it difficult for them to access that kind of early healthcare, that kind of preventative healthcare, is setting us up for more difficult situations later in life. And having done research with older trans people and seen their experiences over the life course of having so many difficulties in trying to get healthcare and of becoming incredibly self-reliant and reliant on sort of like peer social structures. And that is, it's really great that people are able to set themselves up in those ways, you know, like we are strong people, resilient, creative people, but that's also just a terrible outcome for public health. That's not a way for people to get the best health care they can, and for us as a society to be able to get us all the health care that we need, that means as a population we will be doing a lot better.
Just to I guess a question of something that crossed my mind is there any work on whether people, you know, trans and gender diverse people have a regular doctor that they establish a relationship with over time? I mean, of course it would vary, but I'm thinking of endocrinologists or, you know, like what does the structure of that normally look like?
Yeah, well, again, like you would sort of hope so. Like I think because it definitely... I mean, I don't know. I think it would be quite hard to get hormones prescribed sort of ad hoc, like, you know, sort of randomly through clinics. I'm quite sure that would be very difficult, if not impossible. But people, you know, carry the trail of their paperwork that can make that possible. But generally, you know, you would want to have an ongoing relationship with a prescriber. People can need an endocrinologist or a sort of sexual health specialist as well to be monitoring sort of hormone situations. And yeah, I guess it is, I mean, like you're sort of saying about a family doctor, you know, I mean, the idea of, that is sort of a GP's role. The role of a GP is to have a sort of ongoing relationship with someone over their life where you can know their history in that sort of broad sense. And I guess what I'm interested in doing more research on is like exactly what you said, like how do people have, like who and how are people having those relationships and in what places and kinds and environments are they doing that well, you know, both for patients and clinicians? Because I also know that, you know, clinicians get really over, you know, so like people who become known as trans-friendly doctors or, you know, prescribers of trans hormones will get sort of inundated with requests and end up sort of like booked out. So there's definitely a sort of supply and demand issue there too, which again is sort of related to that specialist knowledge sort of problem where people sort of think like, oh, I don't know anything about trans medicine. I don't understand trans medicine. Therefore, I can't treat trans people. When really, you know, like even the hormone prescribing protocols and everything are quite straightforward in a medical sense. You know, it's not an extremely complicated thing to be dealing with.
And I guess there would be sexual health issues that really have nothing to do with somebody's hormone therapy and can be treated with quite independently. And you know what I mean? Because I'm also aware that, you know, when you have an ongoing relationship with one GP, that can also create some issues around the disclosure of certain activities. You know, if you have an ongoing relationship with a GP, then it might be hard to talk about your sex life. It might be hard to talk about your drug use. So you might go somewhere else for that in a more anonymous sort of a setting. But maybe that's another set of issues that, you know, is worth thinking about in future sort of research on the part of all of us.
Yeah, well, definitely. And I also think that, you know, it is like that, again, you know, like if everyone can sort of deal with everyone's problems, then like people who want to have that kind of healthcare, you know, should have access to it as well, you know, because I do like, you know, I think people should have the kind of privacy that they want to have, which might mean having one doctor for something and one for something else. You know, people should be entitled to that and that it might be necessary for them. And yeah, so I would like it to be like that. I know that's also true that, you know, the sexual health sort of medical clinics and people who specialize in that way have definitely been at the forefront of giving good transgender care and have even sort of expanded out in their sort of practice of being like, oh, like we can treat these people because it's clear that there's all these other places that won't treat them. And so like we'll treat them even though it's not really a sexual health issue. But I think like a part of the thing that I think why sort of like HIV prevention and sort of people working in that area and HIV specializing doctors can be so useful in this kind of arena is really precisely like having this kind of non-judgmental openness to listening to people's stories and to being open to the challenges and difficulties and things that, you know, bump against people's assumptions, and that people, you know, clinicians who work in that area tend to have those sorts of values and politics and practices of being medical professionals that make them more amenable to the kinds of care practices that I'm advocating for trans people, which again is quite straightforward. It is just, can you please just stop assuming all this stuff about us? Just wait and like find out. And because it's also true that, you know, there are trans people who don't have sex. There are trans people who have a very uncomfortable relationship to their sexuality. And that's a really important part of sexual health that they deserve to have treated respectfully and appropriately as well, right? So,
well, it's been really great talking to you, Joe, and you know, the experiences and issues that you've mentioned really highlight the importance of the provision of non-judgmental individualized care across the board. Can you give us some of your key thoughts on this as we wrap up the podcast?
I think, look, it really is just like a general principle of openness. And I guess maybe the minutiae of, you know, doctors are busy. I really get that, especially now. And I think sometimes there can be a sort of direct bluntness that comes from trying to be fast. And I think that just being like a little bit slower, just taking a moment to have that kind of rapport at the beginning of a consultation, to just ask people how they're going, make them feel just a little bit more comfortable. You know, those kinds of really small acts of just sort of like, I see you as a human being and I'm here to help you. Those are things that can really ameliorate that kind of fear that can be at the start of an encounter like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, just, you know, a little bit more gently.
Such great advice. thank you, Joe, for this great discussion. And just to remind our listeners that you can access the great paper by Dr. Latham in HIV Australia. It's called HIV Prevention Needs of Trans and Gender Diverse People in Australia. And having read the paper, it really goes through all the different kinds of considerations and the reasons that these considerations are important for health practitioners and clinicians who are working with trans and gender diverse people or who may be working with those people. Thanks very much, Joe.
Thanks very much, Kane. It's great to talk to you, and I really appreciate HIV Australia taking the time to take this on. It means a lot.